This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
So, you know what I want to talk about. All right, so, you know, it's crazy. Since we last spoke, like, Minnesota lost two of its favored sons, from this sexual harassment and misconduct stuff that's sweeping the nation. I mean, it was happening all along, but all of a sudden it's sweeping the nation. And we were going into this election in Alabama, unsure of whether or not someone who'd had all of these allegations against him of, you know, being a creepoid and worse, right? Our president actually going and stumping for him, but you notice he didn't cross the state line into Alabama. I think he can deny that he actually ever stumped. Right. But we woke up this morning and what happened, Gabriel?
Water flowed uphill and a Democrat an election in a state that's roughly 80% Republican.
Unbelievable. And how did they do it? How did they manage to do that?
Well, I think there's a few parts to it. One is that Republican turnout was way down. Something like 100,000 people who normally vote Republican didn't show up. Another is that there were about 20,000 people who made write-in votes, which is way high. And you can probably presume that most of those, obviously the Republicans who stayed home were probably Republicans disenchanted with the nominee. And likewise, probably the overwhelming majority of those write-in votes were Republicans who didn't like their nominee. And then you had higher turnout among Democratic constituencies, especially Black women. And so I don't think there were that many people who switched their vote, but you did see a big turnout story, both in terms of the Republican vote. Suppressed isn't the right word because that implies like a transitive verb, but you had a lot of the Republican vote opted out of, making a moral compromise.
Which is interesting given the turnout was 40%, right? Mm-hmm. Which is way higher than was projected. So usually turnout for an election like this is about 18%.
Yeah.
They projected 25% and then it was 40%.
Yeah, but the turnout was all higher on the Democratic side.
Yeah, which is probably because Democrats have been demoralized in Alabama for such a long time. Perhaps they said, this is our chance. This is our moment.
Do you think it's going to be lasting or do you think it'll be all done in 2 years?
I think it'll be done in 2 years. I mean, I can't imagine that. Who knows? Maybe people will still be listening to Steve Bannon then. But I kind of doubt that in 2 years, the Republican Party of Alabama is going to nominate a pederast who violates court orders.
No, he'll be running for president.
So number one, I think the Democrats all of a sudden have some energy, right? Number two, I mean, maybe Doug Jones will actually do a great job, right? And water will flow uphill again in 2 years. I don't know.
I do know, and it's not going to happen.
Yeah, I'm quite confident it won't either. What do you guys think about the Al Franken resignation?
I kind of buy into the conventional wisdom that he didn't really want to go. He feels like his behavior wasn't egregious enough to justify resignation. That's obviously debatable, but it is pretty clear that his behavior was less egregious than that of many other people who've been in the news lately.
He still resigned, though, under his own volition.
Well, you know what's funny is he technically promised to resign, but hasn't resigned yet. So it's like a weird, it's like if you give me an A now, I'll totally do extra credit after the end of the term over Christmas break.
Yeah, I kind of thought like it was him taking one for the team.
That's
right?
What I thought, too. Like, yeah. Is that he was hurting them on the Moore issue. Is that obviously Moore's behavior was much worse than Franken's behavior, but it was close enough that they could be called out as hypocrites. And so,
close enough? What are you talking about? It wasn't close enough at all.
Well, you're not, to you and to me, there's a clear difference between a guy who's overly flirty and grabby and some guy who may or may not have been banned from the mall and is signing high school yearbooks as a 30-year-old prosecutor. But, you know, it's from somebody else's perspective, they could say, well, the Democratic Party is refusing to purge their perverts. Why should we have to give up a Senate seat to purge our pervert? Right. And so if you take that, you know, apply your sociological verstehen, Leslie.
Yeah. Well, as we've seen with the Republicans, right. You know, you get, you know, accused and you deny, and then you get voted in, right.
But not more.
Or you get to keep your, or you get to keep your job, right? Whereas with the Democrats, you know, it seems as though Franken's like biggest mistake was to say, yeah, I did it and I'm sorry, right? And they're like, okay, you got to get out. You got to get out.
I think it could be a very, very smart move. It all depends on how seriously people want to take this sexual violence and sexual harassment issue. Like, the Democrats just purged themselves of probably one of their top national political figures. Yeah. Definitely one of their top five figures. And I had Roy been elected, well, then I think the vote would have been, or the choice would have been quite clear. One party is, you know, very, very strict on harassment and very strong on the issue.
Except for Menendez. The other one
Yeah, isn't he on his way out as well?
Well, see, this is the funny thing, right? Is that it's easy to push Franken out because the governor of Minnesota is a Democrat, but the governor of Jersey is a Republican, and so
you not for long.
So that but until then, it's not that big a deal to make sure that Medicare fraud doesn't get prosecuted, and you're signing, you know, letters of recommendation for visas for underage mistresses.
Yeah, although although I do think one of the differences that the Democrats can point to, and you know, and you can say that it's, you know, it's I don't know, cynical or what have you, is that Menendez actually had his day in court, right? And he wasn't convicted. So, you know, that's it. So, I mean, that's one of the things you can say.
That's about as credible as saying that you know, the grab him by the pussy tape was fake. I mean,
no. That is, I don't think it's as credible as that. I mean, he did actually face a jury, and it was a hung jury, right?
Yeah, because they did the defense was kind of ridiculous, where they basically said everybody does it, and they're just after him because he's Latino, and let him off on that basis. It was like a Johnny Cochran defense. It was bullshit.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, you know, that if the Democratic Party wanted to do it, they'd at least have that technicality in saying, well, due process.
Oh, I agree. It creates a permission structure for people who want to say there's a difference. But again, in the same way that I'm saying, like, you've got to view it from the view. So I think there's a useful way to think about things is that people take a standard of, can we believe it or must we believe it? And, you know, when something is inconvenient for you to believe, you apply a must we believe it standard. And so if there's something like, well, he was acquitted or not even acquitted, but well, there was a mistrial.
Hung jury.
Yeah.
Hung jury.
You know, or you say, well, you know, the person wrote a note in the yearbook. And so that counts as it being forged, you know, or something like that. You know, or Bernie Bernstein was sniffing around, you know.
I love Bernie Bernstein.
Well, this really was his night last night.
I'm sure, though, that as we're speaking, that there are closed door meetings being had with Menendez right now, with Dems, like trying to urge him right to do the right thing and get out of the way, right? But it's a gentle push. They're not trying to shove him over the cliff like they did with
Franken. I feel like anybody trying to, have you ever tried to pull a starfish off a rock? I think that's what it's going to be like for the Democratic Party to voluntarily leave the Senate.
Yeah, but then the other thing too is I also think that this is part, I actually think it's part of a bigger strategy, right? I mean, so what does Donald Trump do yesterday? He decides to tweet about Gillibrand, right? And basically say, you know, she came to me begging and would do anything. I mean,
no, wait a minute. He said, So there is a distinction, as I said on Twitter yesterday, there is a distinction, colloquial English, there's a distinction between anything and anything, anything. Anything,
yes.
Corruption. Anything means sex.
I don't think that's right. But
and he didn't say anything, anything. He said anything, which means corruption.
Well, all I will say to that is I actually think that he made some people really angry, right? And specifically, he made a lot of women angry. And I think that there are going to be many more Democrats now and some Republicans piling on now to say, you know what, let's have an investigation into all of these sexual misconduct cases.
What I agree with you is that it was interpreted that way. And also, I kind of feel like I do think that statement was misinterpreted, but I also think it couldn't happen to a nicer guy, right? I mean, I kind of think he has it coming to have people misinterpret things he says as sexual innuendo because he is not exactly a gentleman.
Oh my goodness, you were so polite there.
Yeah, well, you know. Well, okay, so what I think is really interesting about this is I view it as kind of a glass half full thing for, you know, the overwhelming strength of partisanship. So, you know, one way to view it is that, hooray, partisanship is weak enough that people were willing to vote against a pederast, you know, which is actually kind of a dog bites man, a man bites dog thing today, right? Because we expect party.
Wait, yeah. Vote against or not show up to vote for?
Thank you. Partisanship was insufficient to motivate people to vote for a pederast just because he had the right letter before his name and therefore is going to, you know, side with them on abortion.
I just jump in, though, and just comment to say that we're basically relieved that partisanship didn't drive us to put a pedophile into
pederast.
Congress. Like, that's...
Do you remember that episode? There's a difference. Pederast. Yeah.
Can you give me the difference? I thought they were
synonymous. The age.
Oh, excuse me. David, do you have something to say here?
Well, I mean, they're definitely the partisanship story works, but I was just looking at the CNN the polls, the exit polls, and only 51% of independents voted for Jones. So Jones barely won independents. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was pretty interesting. Partisanship clearly matters, but, you know, the bigger cleavages were race and age and college education. So race, everybody knows that story, but the age cleavage is really remarkable because Jones won everybody under 49. I mean, he won amongst even middle-aged people, but he just got killed amongst older people. So that was kind of interesting. And then the college education split is really remarkable. I mean, Jones won amongst college graduates, you know? And so it was education, race, age, and partisanship is obviously mixed up with that, but it wasn't just partisanship.
Is this like the tyranny of the old man? What's going on here? Like, is that basically...
Well, old women voted for Moore too, you know, so that's a weird part.
So it's the old people tyranny or something like that.
Isn't everything about that tyranny?
They voted for Brexit. They voted for Trump. You know, I mean, they're pretty consistent. They're more old than partisan, I guess.
I guess. Yeah. I watched Hannity, and honestly, he sounded like an old crank. I realize he himself may not be super old. But like the tenor of his stories are like, look at these foreigners and look at these kids. And I thought, wow, this is like get off my lawn type of news commentary.
Yeah, Jones won even amongst 40-year-olds. Jones won 53-46. But then he loses 53-46 amongst 50s and 60-year-olds and like even higher amongst the older. So the age cleavage was really big too.
What role did gender play?
Well, Jones won women, but – you know, 57-41. You know, that's tricky because I don't know the turnout by race and sex together. And so it's hard to say what share of female vote was African-American relative to the population.
My understanding is that Moore got about 65% of white women, and people were like complaining about that and saying, oh my God. But I always think it's not realistic to expect a demographic to suddenly flip overnight, right? It's not realistic to expect. Mm-hmm. You know, a Republican constituency, which, you know, Southern white women are a Republican constituency, to vote for, to change overnight. But what's interesting is that that's, so to me, 65% instead of 50% is not interesting, it's 65% versus 80%, which is about what Romney got among white women. And so, you know, that 15% drop, 15 percentage point drop, because I have to intimidate our non-quant listeners by pointing out that I know there's a difference. The 15 percentage point drop is that shows, you know, a reflection of people are paying attention to the actual candidate and not just blindly following partisan loyalty.
Yeah, you know, I still, though, I know this is totally not news, but I still cannot get over Republican voting amongst whites without college degrees. I mean, it's just stunning how bad it is there, you know? I like in the Virginia race, did you see this? Democrats did worse amongst whites without college degrees than they did amongst gun owners. And it's just remarkable. They've completely lost whites without college degrees. And I mean, you know, you think historically, at least, a party of organized labor, of the working class, and income is correlated with education, you would think they would at least have some stable constituencies there, but they're just getting killed amongst whites without college degrees.
Well, the converse to that is that Republicans are losing college educated whites. And so, like, Trump did worse among noticeably worse among college educated whites than he did with than did Romney. It's just he basically took 100% of the non-college white vote.
Yeah, but you know, I admit it, this is not news because this has been a slowly emerging trend, but at least since like mid-Clinton, there has been this phenomena of like whites with an economic interest in voting Democrat clearly not doing so. And I know that's not radical news, but it still blows my mind how much it's happening.
What do you think? I always understand it in terms of like separate universes of information, like the rise of radio and Fox News. And they just we're living in completely different Americas now insofar as our understanding as it's conveyed to us through the media.
Well, I think that's part of it, right? But I mean, even in my NPR bubble, I still listen to Fox News, right? And, you know, maybe that's just me. Like, I have sort of this broad palate and I'm a glutton for punishment. But I actually think that you know, this demographic that you're pointing to, I think that they have contacts with people outside, right, of their, you know, of their little bubble. And I think that they do get certain kinds of information. Information that's contrary, perhaps, to, you know, what most of the people in their network seem to agree with or seem to be passing along to each other. And I'm sure that that information gives them pause, but they still go on and vote the way that they do. So I like, you know, whatever, I'd like to give that demographic a lot more credit than, you know, than thinking that they know absolutely no. Yeah.
I'm with Leslie on this. I think you're right. I mean, information would help. Sure, it'd be good. But it doesn't seem like they – even if they – I don't know if more information could correct why they're voting Republican. And I think it's about these values issues. And by values, I mean racism and values of, you know, men's role in society and values of guns and these sorts of cultural issues are just trumping their information on economic issues. And you could say they're actually high information voters because they're voting on things like abortion and they're voting on issues like they view, you know, well, this isn't high information, but they view the white race as under threat, you know, or something like this. So they have information. It's not good information, but they certainly are coding their vote in line with their values.
So I have 2 points. Number one, after we finish taping, I want you guys to give me your home addresses because I'm buying you National Review subscriptions for Christmas because I'm sick of you guys constantly talking about learning stuff from Fox and Hannity and all that stuff. It's a Shonda for the liberals. So,
I actually used to have a National Review subscription and then I let it lapse.
Well, that's fair enough. But I just say like you don't have to listen to the crap, right? I mean, you wouldn't.
Gabriel. But I was just talking to a colleague in the hallway, Gabriel, who teaches. He's an ag economist, and we were talking about teaching intro to public policy. And I actually do tend to agree that in higher education, we're doing a poor job of being politically balanced. I think we could do better. I think there's a real dilemma there, and I think we turn off a lot of young people by coming across as sort of strident ideologue. So I agree. But when you teach intro public policy, there's nothing serious on the right when it comes to issues of climate change, when it comes to issues of even, frankly, poverty and social policy. The right has sort of vacated serious intellectual spaces.
I totally
and no disrespect
to
National Review. Yeah. Okay, but there's, but well, we can argue about this, but I think that the, I mean, there's no serious intellectual on the right arguing against climate change.
So,
and yet that's the mainstream Republican position. So how can I be politically open-minded to Republicans on certain scientific issues when no, I mean, if they're arguing against climate change on the right, they're not intellectually serious.
I'm going to make a few points. So number one, I wasn't saying read National Review because you guys are only talking about NPR. I was just saying don't read crap. Right. And NPR is high quality content. And so I'm glad you got.
But Gabriel, I would conjecture that there's a scarcity of high quality intellectual content on the right.
No, I disagree with that. I think there's actually.
OK, give me a name of someone intellectually serious I should be reading.
David Frum. I like him. Max Boot. I like
him. Yeah, but political hack consultants. I don't know.
Yeah. Max Boot is easy because he's okay. So David Frum, I think is worth reading, okay. Including on the stuff where you probably disagree with him. I'd say that basically anyone associated with Yuval Levin is worth reading. So I would read
with Yuval. Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. So read Yuval Levin. Read his magazine. It's not the Public Interest. It's like the resurrected version of Public Interest. I think it's called National Affairs. Mm-hmm. Read some of those people. And then specifically on the issue of like climate change, there are plenty of right-wing intellectuals who admit that climate change is happening and that it's anthropogenic, but have serious doubts about what a mitigation strategy would involve. And so Jim Manzi is good on that. Yeah. And you could disagree with that, but that's not just like a head in the sand attitude. Right. And that's
no, I understand. But I would say that the right has had a progressive growing hostility to science. And with that, one of the consequences has been that really serious intellectuals stop being. I mean, 30, 40 years ago, you could be hardcore mm-hmm. belief in science and be on the right. These days, you're much less likely.
Well, so I know what you're saying more than you'd think. So the other point is that we're getting into this trap, which I really don't like, of pathologizing people who vote against their objective class interests and based on their ideological interests when it's on the right. And if it's, say, downscale white people voting on the right. And I think there's a flip side to that, which is that it's weird to pathologize that instead of calling it principled. It could be principles you disagree with, but like, I doubt we'd be having the same conversation if we were talking about stockbrokers who vote for the Democratic Party because they care a lot about gay marriage, right? That would be people voting against their economic interests, Gabriel. And we're not pathologizing it and saying, what's the matter with the Upper West Side?
No, it's okay. I was just going to say, I think that there's a difference though, because, I think it's one thing to vote against your economic interest, right, in order to actually help to elevate a group, right, socially, right, and ensure equality for another group. I think some of the platform that other group we're talking about is doing, what they're doing is they're shooting themselves in the foot in terms of their economic interests in order to ensure that other people get less.
But that just amounts to saying that you dislike their principles, which is fine. You don't have to like them. But I mean, from their point of view, they could say they are voting against their interests in order to promote their economic interests in order to promote a principle that they care about, which is to elevate a endangered group. And they are, and the endangered group they would point to is fetuses. Right. So if you look at the argument within the right with people saying like, oh, well, you should even though you don't want to vote for a pederast or somebody who violates court orders or all these other disgusting things about Moore, vast majority of which were known before we found out he was a pederast. It doesn't matter because if you vote for Jones, you're responsible for abortions. Now, you might think that if you're pro-choice, that's great. I'm just saying from their point of view, that is about protecting an endangered group and bringing that endangered group up. And if you don't agree with that, it's only because you disagree with the principle, which is fine. You don't have to. It's about protecting the endangered.
But that wasn't one of the groups that we were talking about before. We're talking about men who are in from that group who are increasingly losing their jobs and not being part of the workforce, and women are rising up, and and then the minority threat. So anyway, I'm shutting up.
You have to distinguish between the Trumpist constituency, within the Republican Party that votes for this kind of craziness in the primary, and then the kind of like what is still the core of the Republican Party in general elections of social conservatives who will vote for these guys reluctantly, both Trump himself and more in the general election, but wouldn't necessarily favor them as much in the primary.
Okay. I mean, yeah, Gabriel, I agree with you. I don't think we should pathologize these people. I just think it's really interesting because there's been such a stark overtime change. So in the early 90s, Democrats would win whites without college degrees. And so what's really changed is this evolution of the white working class, or however we want to call them, the whites without college, their evolution away from the Democrats in the past 20 to 30 years. That's just interesting. Secondly, I would say during this time, their economic insecurity has gotten much worse. So it's one thing to be economically secure and vote in sort of a post-material way about your cultural wedge issues. It's surprising to me when you're increasingly economically insecure to vote against your economic interests. Yeah. But I agree with you. They're voting on things they care deeply about. I agree.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.